Yeah, I think that's great advice. And thank you so much, Stephen, for taking the time today. Thank you for listening to Winner's Bias. If you would like to comment on the show, have any questions, or suggest discussion topics, you can email us at winnersbias@kboo.org. I'm Nate.
And I'm James. We want to remind you that KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform. That means we are funded by you, the listener. If you enjoy the program today, please consider showing your support by making a donation. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. And remember, it's not about the games you play, but everyone you teach along the way. Have a good one. That's when you learn the game.
This is KBOO Pointland.
Andy Whoa looks a scream. Had him on my whoa. Andy Whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My first guest this week is painter and sculptor Tom Kramer. His new show, Super Planet, is on now through November the 30th at Augen Gallery, which is at 716 Northwest Davis Street in Oldtown. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Tom.
Well, thank you, Joseph. It's great to be on with you again.
People will remember you from 2019 when we last had you on. So Super Planet is 19 new carved wood reliefs. You're basically carving hardwoods such as mahogany and then coloring the contours.
Actually, thanks for asking. The biggest piece in the show, which is called Super Planet 2024, it's actually on African mahogany, which is a really rock hard wood. And this one took a long time. This is one of the few pieces ever where I've gone from beginning to end without stopping. It's sort of a continuous take. I started this one in, I think, July, and I didn't finish it until mid-October. It was just, you know, about 300 or 400 hours into it. It was an incredible amount of work. I had no idea how arduous it would be to deal with this very much harder wood. The rest of them are ponderosa pine, most of them, which is a softer wood. I always think of, like, drawing or is sort of like an unplugged guitar in a corner in a room, whereas these things are much more amplified and or orchestral. There's a lot of moving parts, a lot of elaborate, you know, calculation involved with them. This is sort of like the slow food or the slow food movement. Mm-hmm. There's a reward you get at the end of the tunnel through sort of hard work and lots of thinking and lots of non-instant gratification.
In the big Super Planet piece, the brown is the actual color of the wood. So you've used a transparent varnish, I guess, and you can see the little black flecks of the grain in this incredibly hard wood. And then the other colors are sort of streaks of purple, blue, and then your gold leaf and silver leaf kind of look like snow on the mountains in summer. They're very sparingly used. So the dominant color is brown, but then you've got this purple and blue and then black sort of tussling. And the whole thing could be a zoomed in picture of the sun, or it could be something in a biological dish, you know, things breeding.
So I took a trip to Japan about a year ago. So this one is the most directly influenced by their classic concept of wabi-sabi. And when I did this piece, the large super planet, it was very tight. The carving's tight. The application of the color is fairly tight. In other words, the black, the blue, the purple, is carefully put on, so to speak, and the carving was carefully kind of calculated, even though it was improvised at the same time. So I wanted to do with the metallics, the wabi-sabi thing, is it's kind of like throwing it on, almost like I wanted to do something that threw it off a little bit, mm-hmm. the way they're in their art, that when something's too perfect, they do something to screw it up.
So around the corner is the other one called Super Planet number one.
Exactly.
And the colors on this, they look like iridescence, so you've got this silvery rainbow effect. All the dimples are different colors. All the highlights are pretty much silver and gold.
So when I did this, when I did a lot of the pieces of the show, and this one included, I thought of, first of all, I used more than one metallic, which is usually I do the drawing, then I do the carving, then I do the painting, and then on top of that, I do the metallics, and usually I choose only one metallic, whereas this one, is, if you look at it carefully, there's copper, there's silver, and there's gold at the same time. So there's a sort of full-blown, full-on, the opposite of minimalism, you know, maximalism. Mm-hmm.
But maximalist in the subtle kind of pastel way.
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say symphonically, I really like the composer Anton Bruckner. His pieces for orchestra have like, you know, 140 people in the orchestra. That's why you don't hear Bruckner very much, because it's expensive to put his pieces on. His music's kind of cosmic and otherworldly. So I'm sort of going for that otherworldly yet our own world aspect. So in terms of the iridescent thing, I think that's a byproduct of the layering. There's sort of a holographic aspect that happens when you compile a bunch of different materials together.
Mm-hmm. The pattern on that is fairly random. I mean, I do see shapes that look a bit like leaves, but really it looks like a topographical map of a very mountainous country. Even each bubble has a kind of ridge on the top, like a watershed does. But then right next to it is ambrosia, where the pattern of carving is more regular. It looks like a kind of like a flower.
So one of the ideas behind some of these, and this one pretty fairly pronounced, is the idea of what it would be like to be a bug or an ant crawling around a bunch of grass and then crawling inside a flower, and all of a sudden to them it would be like a really big scale. So I think about experimenting with different aspects of scale. So it's all relative to our size, correct? So if you were in a spaceship and entering a different galaxy, this could be something equivalent to it would be like an insect would be to them.
As you come in Augen Gallery, the second piece on your left is a big rectangle.
Right.
It's called Microcosm, and you made it in 2019. It's different from all the others.
It fits into this show because it's sort of microcosmic aspect to it. It's, you know, it's hyper-organic. It has a lot of the same aspects of many pieces in the rest of the show. What's different about it, the number one, like the first Super Planet we talked about, there's fairly minimal use of the metallics. It's mainly the colors. And this one, the original title was, it was going to be Shrinking World, and I was thinking sort of the ecologically more and more how the world is sort of, the natural world is being sort of taken away from us. But I thought, well, that's too much of a downer. So I changed the title to Microcosm.
This was kind of like something you did and then your style changed and now you've come back to it because it kind of presaged what you're doing now.
Sometimes I think time and ideas and development aren't always necessarily in a straight line. They can be sort of sometimes the past, something you thought about or investigated in the past will pop up again in a meaningful way. I set it aside and worked in this show.
So Tom, you said before that you're more influenced by music than other visual art, and sometimes you work on multiples or you put them aside, but except for Super Planet, you did in one go. And here we're talking about Microcosm, which was an old idea, which is relevant again.
Right.
So how kind of linear is your own creative process?
One thing about my work that some people may not know is that often I'll have a starting point, which is in the real world. For example, bark. I love to look at bark or textures of plants or plant design and so forth. And I might photograph something like in the Arboretum, and, you know, blow it up, and just simply by directly translating what I'm looking at, people will think, wow, it's so invented. Well, it isn't. It's just something that's out there. I the classic idea, which is that the real world is much more far out and much more interesting than anything that you could make up. Well, I agree with that. So a lot of it is just taking directly from sources that I find out there in the real world. And in terms of the musical influence, I think that the music, it to me, is the most direct of the art forms and the most emotive, emotional content-wise.
Do you listen to music when you're working?
I listen to music a lot of the times, especially during the show. I often, in prior shows, I listen to like books on tape and radio and stuff like that. But in this show, it's very much oriented towards almost only music, this entire show. Part of it has been the last 4 or 5 years have been so traumatic and so destabilizing that it's hard to live in the political, social world. You sort of want that escape, and music provides a sort of a door to a better world, or a different world at least. In terms of the process, I start with a blank block, obviously, and then usually I draw something on. Like I said, it could be bark, it could be some kind of, it's usually something in the real world,
in,
you know,
natural world.
Yeah, something in the natural world, or even in some other shows I've done stuff in the machine world. I might look at an engine and be interested in engine design, or so then I draw it on, and then the improvisation usually starts shortly thereafter. I just start carving into it, and as I work, it can change. Anytime you do any shift in terms of switching from drawing to carving, it automatically changes it. And then when I'm done with the carving, I return to a, you know, an illusion based thing where with the paint and the gilding, which is a flat thing, and I try to again do the Goldilocks thing, not too little, not too much, mm-hmm. you know, the right amount.
And this is another one with the kind of wabi-sabi, where the gold is rough. It looks like it could have been put on and then scraped off.
One of the basic musical counterpoints is counterpoint. So there's one logic created by the carving and the color, and then counterpoint move or strategy to throw on the gold. Like it's something that's slightly out of place, slightly wrong about it, that makes it more, in, to me, more engaging. So I like to throw in something. In music, it would be live. I mean, if you think about, you know, recorded music in the studio, like the Beatles or whatever, most of it's really calculated out by George Martin or whatever. And then usually their brilliance often is what I've learned from them anyway, is that when I read about them, they would do something on top of it that's like right now in terms of, it makes it more alive that way. I don't like things that are too worked out.
Yeah.
Like when you know what you're doing, then why do it? I like to kind of like not know what I'm doing. And then afterwards I kind of, I can see what I was doing. If it's interesting to me, then I figure, well, it might be interesting to other people. That's kind of how I think about it. I have to entertain myself. I have to be engaged in it. Or else, why would I do it?
So, Tom, you have a signature style in the carvings. The, you know, wood patterned, colored, and then silver and gold foil, you know, on top. Yeah. Do you think you'll be doing the same kind of thing in 10 years?
You know, I probably will, because I like switching through different mediums. I do different mediums, do different styles of work and so forth. This body of work is sort of what I'd call my more, you know, high-end or engaging or slow work, mm-hmm. right? And I think the thing maybe that makes it what others may say about it is the tension between the 2D and the 3D is something I'm really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that it's textural and real, carving is real, painting is an illusion. I think the carving makes it sort of a little bit more primal or direct, or like your body sort of relates to it. I've always been that way. Whenever I look at a piece of sculpture or whatever, mm-hmm. Henry Moore or whoever, I react to it sort of my body first and then maybe my mind later, whereas when I look at a Bacon or a great painter, Picasso or whoever, you know, I'll react to it differently. Like Marshall McLuhan talked about, the medium often is the message. So I'm really aware of that. And
my name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My first guest this week was Tom Kramer. His show, Super Planet, is on now through November the 30th at Augen Gallery in Old Town. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Tom.
Well, thank you. It was great talking to you again, Joseph.
let the rhythm just let the rhythm let the rhythm just let the rhythm
Hi, that song you can hear in the background is Let the Rhythm Just by the Polish Ambassador. This is Joseph. If you would like to go see the Polish Ambassador on New Year's Eve at McMenamin's Crystal Ballroom, answer this trivia question and email me to win a pair of tickets. The question is, in Salvador Dali's painting, Burning Something and Telephones, what is the something? What is burning in the background? Okay, if you know without Googling it, email me, josephgalavan@gmail.com, and I will use a randomizer to pick one of the winning entries, and you'll win a pair of tickets to see the Polish Ambassador at McMenamin's Crystal Ballroom this New Year's Eve. Thanks. This is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My second guest this week is ceramic artist Paige Wright. Her show, Swimming with a Melting Crown, is on now at Sheffer's Projects, which is at 134 Southeast Taylor, Suite 203, and it's on through November 30th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus for the first time, Paige.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to get visual stuff on the radio.
You have this fantastic room. You must have 20-odd pieces here. Mostly heads, you know, busts. Some are flat, sort of wall-mounted faces. A lot of hands, so individual hands scattered around the room, the odd eye. But what grabs you is these busts where you've used the glaze in different colors to paint patterns on the faces. So let's talk about this one. As you come in the door, turn right. And what's it called?
To Have an Eye.
So it's a kind of red, like terracotta colored face with a little bit of shoulders, a throne base. The hair is made of slab techniques of flat clay that you've then glazed. But the face has this stripy gray grid on it, and it's like a veil that comes down the forehead, and it overlaps with the center of the face, which is yellow and black, and it makes a kind of eye shape where the two sort of curves intersect, like a Venn diagram. What was this piece about when you were making it?
It's about kind of collective eye consciousness, where you have to be able to see something and to kind of put things together. Using the use of an eye is very interesting, and I love sculpting eyes. There's two eyes on this face, but then there's this like weird central cycloptic form where it's kind of funny, like to have an eye is that comment to, you know, where you see something well, but it's just one eye. Like, I think that that's really a funny thing about what we call and how we use eyeballs. I don't know, a lot of visual collective vocabulary is in the eye.
Just explain the title of the show, Swimming with a Melting Crown, because you glaze these and often the glaze runs, you know. You paint it pretty accurately, but occasionally it runs. So what is that, the melting crown?
The Swimming with a Melting Crown talks a lot about body mechanics, also mechanics of the ceramic material. I love materiality, and I like that to come through in my work. And then crown is also something that the decorative nature of human beauty, and we like to decorate, but it's also then like the name of where we would put that decoration too. So the relationship between body and decoration, and how we've kind of used nature that inspires our decoration. Swimming is something that we do, the body mechanics. So swimming we do for lots of different reasons. So fun, exercise, survival. So it can talk about the multifacetedness of the human structure. So that's calls to the face, where the face is this beautiful encapsulation that has all these tiny little parts of the moving body and how they work all so well together. So sculpting the face is very important. And then melting is like all things that are ceramic have to be in theory melted. So even the clay, like the clay gets to a molten stage, but then that the clay where I'm decorating these has like that a decorative quality. Like there's the understanding the science of what glaze is doing in relationship to how I play with it. So I love the conversation between science and play, understanding. It's like the in one of my artist statements I was talking about the comedic roast and how where you kind of have to like ultimately really respect somebody to tell a joke that's mean but not mean, it's cutting and it's funny, or to be funny you can't be super mean. So that's where the materiality and the melting comes from. So melting can be fun, melting can quote unquote ruin something where you maybe didn't plan it, but then the melt can only really happen in the kiln like that. Like a drip in ceramics is like nothing else can make that shape.
The biggest bust, it looks like a man's face. He has kind of a black hair, a very weak chin, or just a double chin. His face is sort of in these green, dark and pale green chevrons. And my favorite bit is his black hair melted like Rudy Giuliani's hair dye coming down his temple and the front of his head. And yet you pointed out that that drip is unlike, it's not a drip you put on with a paintbrush. It's a drip that came about when the glaze melted and the black glaze trickled down the front of the face.
Correct. Yeah, when you open up a kiln and you kind of go, oh, I guess that's what you did in there. And that's what I think about when they're in there. They're like, you're going to do your own thing. Mm-hmm. You can program it all you want and control it, but there's always that slight, like, I guess that's what heat work is going to do to you and where it travels. It's kind of that fun play. And I definitely didn't, like, I opened that one up. This one was definitely a surprise to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's close to where you could definitely think that it was put on like that. But then you start looking closer and, yeah, how it runs down the forehead and starts hitting other glazes. And then they start melting together. That would be really hard to do with the hand. So I think that there's that closer reward when you get in there and you start being like, well, actually, how did that melt? And you have to go, oh yeah, the kiln did that. So it is ceramic. There's the power of ceramics working for sure.
Most of these busts have on the sort of white pedestal, they have a hand, you know, cut off at the wrist, a ceramic hand, highly glazed, often in colors, dots, stripes. The one in front of this guy is black with sort of pink and orange marks, and in the back of the hand, pink stripes on the kind of brown clay. So you take a lot of care sculpting eyes and ears. You know, they're sort of realistic, and these hands are just perfect. Why do you sculpt the hands this way?
The hands are a celebration of what the hands are to me, where I want to spend time looking at them. I love the conversation that not only happens when I'm making something with myself, but then I can further talk about when I'm showing my work. So I get to talk to you about how amazing the hand is because you recognize like, oh, she's taken a lot of time and care and sculpted that, and they're not cast, they're, you know, stroke by stroke, rendered from through my eyes, out my hands, that opinion is put out so that body can be recognized and celebrated.
Is that solid clay or is it hollow?
The hands are built solid and then hollowed out, which is different than the heads. They're coil built. So It's just like I think that one's just a size difference too.
Yeah. Over on the left hand wall, there's a bust. Two little busts on a shelf with a hand, and then stuck up on the wall at like 7 feet high, there's a small looks like half a grapefruit, but it has an eyeball. It kind of looks like a whale when they look at you out of the water. That sort of creepy eye looking at you. And it's, again, it has the stripes. The left half of the circle is light blue on the brown clay. And then the eyeball, you know, goes straight over the eye. Why would you isolate something like this?
Like the sections, I like to kind of undescribe what I've described already, so it kind of highlights again the importance of the sculpting, and then like highlighting, I want to put color on there, but I think that they just another way of describing and objectifying that shape, but also celebrating and merging the two at the same. So mm-hmm. The isolation is to celebrate both and the importance of them living together.
Are the stripes kind of like, you know, when a photographer puts someone in front of Venetian blinds and their body gets striped? Is it that? You said you're trying to undescribe?
Kind of. It's just, well, I don't want to, like, I'm not going to paint it where I have flesh tones and paint in a shadow where it, you know, goes into the head and I've sculpted the recession part. I'm not going to re-describe that in paint because I think the validness of the sculpting should sing on its own terms. Mm-hmm. The striping is kind of a tool I use where I can add color but not suffocate that surface. The clay is, I think, just as important as the glaze. I want the sculpting and the subtleties of the handwork to come through and not be swallowed by like a saran wrappy shiny surface. So it's kind of like melding of the two worlds where you have color and clay. Mm-hmm. But then I also love stripes. Stripes have like a whole nother baggage that I could get into. But
you're the only American I've ever met who's been to Sunderland, which is in the northeast of England near Newcastle. And you went there, did a term of glass blowing.
It did.
And it frustrated you because you couldn't touch the hot glass. Yes. Whereas you can touch the clay. There are four kind of masks on the wall, beautiful. And one of them is green, sort of golf course green. It has this flock. And then it's got a kind of lightning strike of gold across the face. Mm-hmm. And what was that?
The kintsugi fix. The mending with gold comes from a Japanese technique where this piece specifically broke in the kiln, or it dunted is the ceramic term, where the clay body shocks itself by not being able to shrink back together, similarly to glass, actually, so an annealing version. So the celebration of that ceramic material, even though it broke, and I think that we, as ceramicists, and I think human beings in general, like, have this, oh my god, my ceramic broke, what do I do? And so I think that this is, you know, there's like that, oh, we put ourselves back together concept, but it kind of has this like talking in circles about like what breaks but fixing it, and then that lightning strike objective painterly quality of that line that's only created in the kiln, like that's what it's actually doing in the kiln, is it's like striking, and we have that like.
And the model had a thyroid problem. How does that fit into this story?
The person is an actor and uses their face as a tool, so all of these are specific people that are in the public eye and use their body to talk about themselves, and so they put themselves out there, and when you have maybe something that's not distinctively, you know, quote unquote beautiful, like I find it so unique, and her eyes are so amazing to me sculpturally, that when the kintsugi line follows right through the eyes, it just puts that pin on that, or the nail on the head of that. The eyes are this like beacon of, they're broken but they're beautiful, and they're what makes that person unique.
Mm-hmm. So that's a woman?
Yes. Karen Robinson, she plays like a council member in Schitt's Creek, on the show Schitt's Creek. Yeah.
Does she give you the rights to her face?
No. No, technically it has more than 40% of me changing her face. So I think I can, I don't know if it's as much to her likeness, and maybe I should write her a letter. Or maybe she can just have this piece when I'm done with it. I don't know.
What is it about, you know, the alchemy of glazes that just attracts you so much?
it's this ability to kind of understand something and feeling legitimate in your practice or in as a ceramicist, the validation of contributing to the community. Like I've researched it, I'm serious about this thing, but then also I get to play with it and show who I am. So it's this toss up of that kind of conversation of why melting is in the title. Like I'm here to contribute and be a part of it and put my two cents in, but at the same time, like, it gives me this place of confidence that I can play and be myself and talk about stuff that I want to talk about and hopefully, you know, engage other people and inspire people to kind of find their own confident place to play. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My second guest this week was Paige Wright, a ceramic artist. Her show, Swimming with a Melting Crown, is on now at Sheffus Projects in Inner Southeast through November 30th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Paige.
Thank you so much for having me.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Have him on my wall. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
Estás escuchando KBOO Portland. Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 19 de noviembre del 2024.